This is Iconic with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host JM, and with me today is Nick.
Hey.
As Mark could not make it today, we have a special co-host. Welcome back to Wade Rocket. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
Today we're looking at two of the more narrative-based components of 13th Age, the One Unique Thing and Backgrounds. Our goal is to show you how you can get more out of your campaigns with both of these mechanics and how to encourage them both as a player and a GM to make your stories even better. So let's head into One Unique Thing.
One Unique Thing.
All right, we're in One Unique Thing. Wade, do you want to give us a start here?
Okay, I would be glad to. I will speak to the notional listener who has not heard of the One Unique Thing, which is one of the most noteworthy aspects of 13th Age. I think if you're going to say what makes 13th Age different from, you know, other role-playing games, what's distinctive about it, I think that is one of the three or four things that you would bring up, along with backgrounds, icon relationships, and maybe the escalation die. The One Unique Thing is an attribute of your character, and it's something that you come up with during character generation. And the question is, the question that the GM will ask you is, what makes your character unique in all the world? What are you the only one of? And it can be something very powerful and world-changing. One of the examples in the book is, I am the only halfling paladin of the Empire. Before, I think it was during like pre-playtesting, Jonathan Tweed was playing with Peter Adkison, and he said, I'm a wizard and all wizards lie. And so these are things that just really make a big dent in the campaign world. Say, oh, wow. No halflings are paladins of the Empire, or, wow, all wizards in this campaign now are untrustworthy. So that's a really big and powerful One Unique Thing. A minor One Unique Thing, I actually have one in my campaign. I've had a couple in my campaign. One was a halfling street thief who could play the halfling national anthem on his armpit. And more recently, there's a character who is a wizard, and he's an elf. And his One Unique Thing is, no one knows I'm an elf. And which sort of, you know, put a big question mark over my head, and maybe we'll get into that a little bit later about the kinds of questions that One Unique Things bring up and kind of how you drill down to get to the bottom of what this is really all about. So the One Unique Thing is a very powerful storytelling tool, and as written, it's not something that gives you a mechanical benefit. It's pure story. There are guidelines in the book, though, for if your player really wants a One Unique Thing that gives them some sort of mechanical benefit, like I am the only dwarf who can fly. There's sort of some guidance on how you could handle that.
And Rob, during one of our interviews with him, mentioned he had somebody who walked 6 inches above the ground, and sometimes the ground took snaps at him.
Yes, that was from the BJ Shays Geek Nation podcast. You can listen to that. They have about four series of actual play where Rob runs 13th Age for them. And it was just interesting to hear how that character evolved from, you know, I walk 6 inches above the ground, and by the end of it, it was, okay, you're an elf, and the ground actually rejects you, and so you walk around on these special shoes, and if you hit a wall, then you'll bounce like a ping pong ball. It was just really interesting to hear how that evolved from just this weird little trait to him having this destiny where he's destined to ascend into the overworld.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're a very interesting piece of 13th Age, and as a GM, I could talk for quite a bit about how they're influencing even my Planescape game. But let's start off with Nick, as a player, who's you predominantly play 13th Age. You don't necessarily run it.
Correct.
What are your thoughts on a One Unique Thing from a player's perspective?
I think that it's a very... I think every player, when they start playing a game, they want to somehow feel special. They want to feel like they have something that no one else has, bring something that no one else brings to the table, and maybe be a little bit more useful, have a little bit more flair to the storytelling. And I think the one unique thing is a great way for players to do that. I think where some players get hung up is, how do I come up with a creative one unique thing? I mean, walking 6 inches above the ground is a great one, but it's already taken, you know, so trying to come up with something that is truly unique. But I've found that they're a lot of fun to come up with. The one that for the 13th Age game that I'm playing right now, I had one idea, and the more I thought about it, I was like, well, let's change it up a little bit. Let's expand this a little bit. Let's answer the question, why is this unique, or how did this come about? Am I truly the only person in the world who has this thing? And it was a fun element of the role-playing game that extended for long beyond just the gameplay session.
Well, let's chat about that real quick. So one of the things I tried to do from a GM's perspective, as my players started coming up with their one unique thing, I pushed back with, well, why is that? You know, why are you unique? And some players just were like, well, this is just the way it is. I don't really care how it affects it. And like with Nick, he originally came with the fact that he had the memories of a prime in his head. So somebody from a prime material world as a Planescape character. And eventually we were able to drill it down to, there was this wizard on this world who tried to cast a spell of immortality and basically just transferred his consciousness into the body died, but the wizard's consciousness is tied into his, you know, is sharing Nick's character's head with him.
So it could have been something as simple as, I hear voices in my head, but it's actually another consciousness. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that and I'm still trying to figure out the balance of this is, one unique things, like you said, Wade, are not designed to have a mechanical benefit. And as the rules are written, it's more specifically in relation to combat. Once you get out of combat, the rules seem to be a little bit more free flow, work with your GM, figure something out, whatever works for you guys. If it makes the story interesting, go for it. And still trying to figure out, can I use my one unique thing in some sort of way of not just, oh, I start talking to myself because I hear voices, but as, okay, well, I have this wizard living in my head. Does that mean that I can understand this magical writing? Or do I see that ward or something to that effect? Still trying to figure all that out.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get into backgrounds, because I think there's a really good tie between backgrounds and one unique things. But Wade, as a GM, what do you like about one unique things? How do you get the most out of them for your campaign?
Well, one unique things, as you've mentioned, have one great advantage in that they get my players invested in the setting and the campaign right away. All of the kind of unique mechanics of 13th Age, the backgrounds and the icon relationships, do as well. The one unique thing I think is very strong about doing that. And so it's always helpful when you're a GM and your players buy in at the beginning and you don't have to kind of wheedle them into accepting what's going on. They have a stake in what's going on right from the beginning because they helped create that.
Mm-hmm.
When my sorcerer player came up with the one unique thing, I was the subject of magical experiments by servants of the Archmage. That led to this campaign thread with this ongoing story arc, and that's all about her. And so which is the other thing about one unique thing that I really like as a GM, is that it gives me great story hooks. So when she said that, I immediately knew that I had a, you know, conspiracy of wizards somewhere in the Empire who for some reason are kidnapping elf sorceresses and subjecting them to magical experiments. Maybe it's just her, maybe it's lots of them. And that, you know, the reason that she is out here on the frontier adventuring is because she has fled from wherever it was they were holding her and is just as far away from them as she could possibly be and hiding out. And so now, of course, they found out where she is and are starting to close in, and various weird things are happening to her character that seem to be a side effect of those experiments. And it's just neat because whenever that comes up, you know, that came from her. She came up with that whole aspect of the campaign. And so I'm constantly engaging her in the story with something that she's very personally invested in, and she told me that she wants to be a part of this campaign, which is pretty awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Actually, and you know, it's funny, as we were talking, I quickly did a search and I came up with a blog post from the chatty GM on critical hits. Have you seen this where he creates a one unique thing template?
No.
Yeah, it's a hack of the one unique thing template, which is inspired from Luke Crane and Jared Sorensen's Free Market RPG. Mm-hmm. And so at his table, he asked his players to write their one unique thing as a one-sentence declaration that includes at least three of the following elements: an icon, a place, a person, an item, a time, and an organization. So it's, I was granted the Sword of Sorrows by the skeletal hand of my undead father when our village cemetery saw minions of the Lich King arise from it. I was born in the High Druid's most sacred grove during the last double lunar eclipse. My destiny will unfold at the apex of the next one. Which I thought was, and I prefer to keep things a little more free-form, but I thought that was a really interesting approach because some of my favorite One Unique Things work in tandem with icons and backgrounds.
Yes.
Like I was kidnapped by servants of the Archmage. It's like, okay, well, there's your icon relationship. You have a conflicted relationship with the Archmage, because you don't know if he's aware of your kidnapping or not. You know, I am the only survivor of a town raised by the army of the Orc Lord. Right there, you have your villain is, okay, negative relationship with the Orc Lord. And so I really like that a lot as kind of a way to think about it and tie it into other elements of the game.
Yeah, the narrative elements, so the one unique thing and the icon relationships and the backgrounds, you really can get some good synergy going between the three of those to really make your character not just invested in the story, but invested in the way 13th Age is played.
Well, we'll have to track down that template and put it in our show notes. I know that for a lot of players who struggle with coming up with some creative way of coming up, you know, defining what their one unique thing is, having some sort of template or a series of questions to answer might really help them out.
Gareth at Gen Con was telling me about how one of his players just came up with the one unique thing, I have a bad memory. And Gareth's first thought was, well, if that's unique, that means everyone else in the world has a really good memory, which means why would anyone write anything down?
Hmm.
Which, first of all, the man's mind moves far faster than mine does. That is a great leap. I don't think that's actually how it played out at the table, but I mean, that's a great example of a GM taking a character's one unique thing and retroactively changing the entire world off of it.
That's a really good point. I think it's important for the players and the GMs to work together on defining what the one unique things are and how they do impact both the players and the setting.
Yeah, certainly. You know, I think, I can't remember if you guys told me about it or if I heard about it from somebody else, but the I have a bad memory, I actually heard about it from someone, and it turned out that, what was it? It was like they're constantly moving through alternate universes or parallel universes.
That was that's how Gareth played it at the table, or how they established that they were jumping between timelines, which is why he doesn't really remember. He doesn't know how this universe played out compared to the one he was just in. Again,
yeah, he has a great memory. He's just remembering the wrong universe.
Exactly.
Well, I just wanted to return to that player who said, nobody knows I'm an elf. And I haven't really talked to the player about this, but it might be an example of a one unique thing that Rob Hainso has talked about, where the player is saying, I don't really want to make a big deal out of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like I'm the only elf who doesn't have pointy ears. Just like, okay, we're just going to let that be for a while. It's not really big or showy. Because I asked him, I said, why does nobody know you're an elf? He said, well, because I have my hood up, so it covers my pointy ears. And I said, so is there a magical aura around you that prevents people from finding out you're an elf? Well, even if you had your hood down, would they see you as something else? He said, no, I just have my hood up. I said, does the elf queen know that you're an elf? He said, probably. So I'm just dying to get in there and say, you know, maybe there's something really special about him that, you know, reality is warped around him, so it's impossible to discern that he's an elf, and there's some really cool reason for it, but I don't want to push that if that's not a place that he wants to go.
And that's a good point. Again, in the Planescape group that I'm running, I had a couple of people who were willing to, who really seemed excited about digging into the why of their initial one unique thing, and I had a couple of people who were like, no, I just want to leave it the way it was, and as a GM, you should be respectful of both.
Yeah.
And flexible, too. I think that maybe down the road, if those players who are new to 13th Age, who don't quite understand what place one unique things bring, you know, what part of the game one unique things are, maybe down the road, give them the flexibility of, okay, now that you're invested and you're a little bit more, have a little bit more information or a better idea of who your character is, then you can come back and retroactively define what your one unique thing is, or maybe make something happen to them in the game that is a one unique thing.
So as I mentioned, Nick has a one unique thing that where he has a wizard in his head, and this will provide a good transition into backgrounds, as I pushed back to him that if he wanted a little bit more mechanical benefit to his wizard living in his brain, he should pull a background out on that. So, Nick, why don't you explain what backgrounds are and kind of how we use them in 13th Age?
Well, backgrounds are the pieces of your character's story that have led them to where they're at right now. And those pieces of the stories that are the major definers, if you will, of their history do provide a mechanical benefit to skill checks and possibly in combat if you're doing some special maneuver that you say, hey, I want to provide an asset to this other person by firing an arrow off this wall because I won an archery contest or something to that effect. But for the most part, it's just for the narrative, but giving you a boon to the skill checks. And like the one unique things, they're very free-formed, very loose, that you can say that you're a gladiator, and based on you being a gladiator, you could have skill checks for charisma. You can, you know, saying, well, I know how to woo the crowds because I was stood on the sands and I knew how to act the part to get the best reaction out of the crowd and use that to get your bonus to your die roll if you're trying to convince a guard to let you by or something like that. It requires you to use your imagination to take your background, explain to the GM and the rest of the players, how does this background affect this situation in such a way that I can get a bonus to my die roll?
Nick, as one of the players in my group, knows that that's how I run them. I push back a little bit to the players and say, well, how does this background, how are you justifying using this background? Not in a, I'm not going to give it to you, but as in a, let's get a little bit more story, flesh out your history a little bit more. Wade, how do you use backgrounds at your table?
Backgrounds at my table, well, again, so there's from a GM's perspective and a player's perspective, mm-hmm. And even more so, maybe it's a tactical versus a strategic use of backgrounds. One use of backgrounds for me, which comes up a lot and which is very important to me, is, again, like the one unique thing, it's a list of the people that the characters used to be mm-hmm. before they arrived on the scene, you know, before the opening scene of this movie. And so I'm always drawing on that in order to come up with new plot lines, in order to come up with NPCs and antagonists that are relevant and meaningful to them. You know, the background of my paladin is that he's, one of his backgrounds is he's an imperial inquisitor. And also before that, he was a cloistered scholar in the imperial city of Axis. And so I always try to come up with, you know, elements of the game that have to do with study and research and scholarship, and there's, you know, some of the treasures will sometimes be, you know, they'll have historical significance or something like that, because, again, my player Eric has signaled to me, this is the kind of thing that, you know, I want, and, mm-hmm. you know, and that I want my character to run across. And so I will do things like that. In terms of using backgrounds, I mean, obviously, backgrounds are there in order to provide bonuses to checks of various kinds, and so it's interesting. I mean, a lot of the times, I only want to roll when it's cool to do so,
mm-hmm.
and so sometimes I'll say, if anyone has a background in that relates to this, then you just know it or you see it, Or if you have a background witted to this, then roll on it. Sometimes I'll say, go ahead and make a wisdom check or an intelligence check on this, and check your appropriate backgrounds. And if you can make the case that it's applicable, add that bonus.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in that kind of tactical sense, they're not a really powerful part of the game because they don't require people to make a ton of skill checks. But if the chips were really down and they wanted to debate with me over whether a background could apply to pull off something in particular, I would love that and would welcome it because I live for that kind of thing.
One of the ways that I think I do kind of the same thing is I apply an almost, I steal from Trail of Cthulhu, the way their investigative skills work.
Ah, yes.
I keep the list of backgrounds on my tablet in front of me. And so when characters walk into a scene, I will give them clues or information based solely off their backgrounds. If they want more information, then they can roll against it. But they're guaranteed to, okay, Christopher's a mercenary in the Blood War. He can, just by arriving on the scene of the bandit attack, realize, okay, these were definitely devils that did this. They're highly organized, very precise. If he wants a little more information, he can roll on it. Again, it kind of keeps the story moving, and as you said, only rolls when it's cool to roll, when you get, when you have something truly on the line.
Yeah. Actually, a Cthulhu chick, Ruth, who was on one of our panels at Gen Con, is thinking of writing something about investigative 13th Age games, because she, of course, loves Trail of Cthulhu,
mm-hmm.
and the gumshoe system, and so that's something we're trying to persuade her to write.
So I may be out there. I am not, well, I agree that backgrounds do very well as snapshots of who characters were, what they did before they got to here. I'm very flexible when it comes to backgrounds. One of the guys in our Planescape group has a thief minion. He's playing a necromancer, and so one of his backgrounds is a previous party member that he has resurrected and uses as a thief background. What are some unique...
Oh.
What are some unique, or I've also allowed psionics to be used as backgrounds. Like one of my players has telepathy as a background, so she uses it for what you would have social checks for, what you would have, or telekinesis, where she uses it to, athletic. She's even used it as like sleight of hand before, aiding things. What are some unique ways you could be using backgrounds at your table? Nick, what do you think from a player's perspective?
Well, one of the first ways that comes to mind, and Wade, you mentioned using your one unique thing as a tie-in to your icons, is to use your background as your tie-in to the icons.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's what I'm doing with my character. Is one of my backgrounds is that I was a minder of the Hall of Records. And so as a result of that, I have a positive relationship with the faction that runs the Hall of Records. And the name of the faction is escaping me at the moment.
Unacceptable, Nick. We've only played one session. How do you not remember the 30 icons that I created for this?
But so in my mind, the story of my character is that I was a minder for the Hall of Records for a number of years, and so as a result of that, I have a very positive relationship with
the Fated.
The Fated. So using your backgrounds to do your tie-ins to your icons would be one way of extending it beyond just the mechanical benefit of your checks.
Yeah, if there's one thing that drives me crazy, and I'm not easily driven crazy, but if there's one thing that drives me crazy, it's when people limit their backgrounds to something like sailing or, whatever, climb. Yeah, I mean, that's an extreme example, but, or blacksmithing, something like that. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that is perfectly legitimate, but you could get so much more if you were a blacksmith in the smithy of, right-hand man of the emperor in Axis. Because, then you could know things about smithing, and you could also know something about Axis, and you could know things about life in the imperial court. And why would you not want all those things? why would you not want to get as much out of your background as you can? Backgrounds that tie into icons and to places are just really powerful, and I think that everyone should take advantage of them, not just because of the utility, but because it's really nice for the GM because, it fills in the blanks in the world, and the GM says, now I know something about how the Imperial Court in Axis works, and that the Emperor has this right-hand person who has a personal blacksmith.
I think it's important for players, too, to keep in mind or to build a storyline of how their backgrounds line up. How, you know, not just I was this person here and this person there and this person there, but how did I get from point A to point B to point C to where I'm at right now? And trying to build some sort of timeline of, well, I was a professional gambler here, and that got me a job, and I ended up becoming a mercenary, and then I had this wizard inject himself into my memory, and so I decided to go work at the Hall of Records to get his voice out of my head or keep him, you know, happy or something like that, and build this storyline of who is your character, you know, and helping define that, and then, you know, like you were saying, work with the GM to figure out how does that help shape the world too.
I thought of something the other day, and inadvertently delighted myself. I was just so proud of this. But I was thinking about 13th Age and kind of old school D&D, and how, at the beginning, when the playtest launched, One Unique Things were very controversial on some message forums because those people kind of really liked the old school D&D vibe of you start as a zero and work your way up to a hero, and then the thought that you would be a special snowflake right out of the box just drove them nuts. And I thought to myself, okay, so that old school D&D is kind of like the 1977 Star Wars movie, and Luke Skywalker is your hero, and he's just a farmer. He's a farmer, and someone has given him a sword and sent him off to fight the Empire and save the princess. And Luke Skywalker in The Empire Strikes Back is a 13th Age character. He's better at what he does. He has one unique thing, is that he's the only son of Darth Vader, Lord of the Sith, and right-hand man to the Emperor. And he has icon relationships, because now the Emperor is interested in him, and Darth Vader is interested in him, and he's valuable to the rebellion. He's still not very influential or powerful, but he's vitally important to the goings-on in the galaxy in a way that isn't immediately apparent. And so if you take it as, okay, Luke Skywalker in Empire Strikes Back is a first-level 13th Age character, then his backgrounds could be moisture farmer, you know, drag racer, amateur mechanic, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So that was my little, like, thing, you know, getting to put Star Wars and 13th Age together. I added some geek points onto my card.
Well, and I think, too, something to bear in mind is as you are exploring your character and playing in your world and going through the different sessions, you could always bring it up to the GM to change your backgrounds. You know, if some major life event happens and something changes, then, you know, you can change your background.
You could even change your one unique thing, mm-hmm. If something especially momentous changes.
One of our players, the guy who has the undead thief minion as a background, was wondering, you know, well, do my backgrounds have other effects besides just skill rolls? Things like, can I call upon contacts? Can I call upon, you know, different organizations and use my background numbers for that? What are your thoughts on that, Wade?
On using backgrounds almost as you would icon relationships, where you could call upon, like, if you have a background as a thief, could you call on the Thieves Guild? That kind of thing?
I hadn't thought about it that way. He was just wondering, you know, if he could do it to make a streetwise check to find someone not quite icon level in a city.
I would absolutely let him do that. Again, going with the street thief, I was a street thief in Shadowport. It's like, well, then you could. I would let them use that background to say, you know, hey, I heard that one of the guys I knew back in Shadowport, back in my wild youth, is here in this city, and he's gone respectable, and he's a merchant. You know, and I'm going to try to find him. You know, I'm like, and I mean, hell, I might just say, yeah, okay, go for it. but if it were exciting to make that a skill check and say, you know, can I, you know, is there a possibility that somebody from Shadowport is here in Horizon that I can make contact with, then I might say, yeah, go ahead, make that skill check, and if you succeed, then yes, I will make that happen. Yeah, that's a really cool idea. I like that.
Luke is a wealth of good ideas. He doesn't get behind the screen as often as I'd like, but he's always enjoyable to have in a game.
And that's honestly one thing that I love about 13th Age, and one of the things that I think separates itself from a lot of other role-playing games out there is that so much of the focus of the game is on building a fascinating, exciting story and not just going through and slaying some monsters. And I feel like the One Unique Things and the backgrounds are the best tools that players have to help write that story.
Well, as Wade said, for a GM, they are key markers for your players to tell you what they want the game to be about. If you throw icon relationships in there, you could almost come to the table with nothing planned as a GM and just go from there. If your player has a relationship with the Lich King, then obviously they want the Lich King to be involved. They're a powerful tool for players to tell the GM, this is what I want the story to be about, and they're great keystones for GMs to focus on as they tell their campaign. Any final thoughts on either of these two things? One Unique Things or backgrounds?
Only that they're awesome, and it's hard to look at another game that doesn't have them and say, why doesn't the skill system work like backgrounds? It's so cool.
Yeah. Well, I think of a story or a book that you really like, and in addition to having the character move forward in the timeline, there's going to be times where they stop and look back and define in some way the motivations of why they're, or how they got here, why they're doing things that they're doing things. And the backgrounds of the One Unique Things are that backstory to the characters that you're playing with.
I will say that one of the few times I actually got to experience 13th Age as a player was when I played Make Your Own Luck with Aaron Rodebush and on Google Plus. And my character was the son of a minor kind of backcountry noble. And so I said that meant that I knew, you know, farming. I had farm wisdom. And knowing stuff about farming proved to be an incredibly useful background. I could tie almost anything. It's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, I could dig this, you know, defensive trench because I dug a lot of pits back in, you know, back on the farm. I'm an expert digger.
Yeah. You know. I think you're only bounded by your imagination.
Exactly.
We are pleased to announce our first contest for the Iconic Podcast. As you know, the White Dragon is our mascot, and so we're asking you, our listeners, to submit the answer to the following question. Who was the White Dragon, and why did the Wizard King kill him?
When you submit your entries, the things that we are looking for are creativity and entertainment. We will look at all of the submissions and evaluate them, and whichever one we like best or think that we could spin the best campaign off of, we will choose that as the winner. So, Wade, why don't you go ahead and tell us what the winners get?
Well, what could be better than a Pelgrane store voucher in a beautiful PDF format? So we'll be giving away three Pelgrane store vouchers, good for purchase of any product on the Pelgrane Press shop online, in the amounts of $20 for the grand prize, $10, and $5.
This contest ends October 31st, so make sure we have your email submissions to whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com before then.
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.